Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Now, lest we get too overboard, because I know we have a few of them in here, a little known secret, don't tell my dean, I am also an LCPC from State of Illinois. And so I'm duly licensed, and so for those of you who are LPC, I know Howard, you have your LPC, and there may be others in the room, I got you back, man. And we've been there and through all of that. So we can talk about it in terms of social work or counselor ed values if people want to do that. But again, the two parallel on this kind of a discussion, and so I don't know that we need to tear them apart. But we can go there. That's among the credentials you know that Rodney mentioned, for probably good reason. We want to be able to also then identify the implications of at least five different values from DSM-5. One of the things, and I will go through why this has happened in our field, but one of the things that I'm real conscious of when I teach values and ethics in social work, as opposed to in a seminary context. Last week I was with the State Board of Chaplains, and when you talk to chaplains about values and ethics in most other professions outside of counseling start from a theology or a philosophy, because after all, ethics is the applied field of philosophy. You want to know what philosophers do other than think grandiose thoughts. Their actual application field is called ethics. And so, for the most part, in other fields, we start from a major philosophy area. Every time I try to talk about major philosophy in most of my classes, students glaze over, and we don't get very far. Can you say that again for my students? So, bottom line is that the field of social work went into a very different style of values and ethics. And we'll again get into some of that. So we'll talk about what that looks like and where we head with that. What we're going to start off by doing is actually talking a little bit of philosophy, a little bit of humanism, evidence-based, positivism, and of course faith and practice. We will walk through the NASW Code of Ethics very briefly, and then discussion of specific values. There we go. There is one other thing. I'm stealing this from the speaker on set. Oh, that's certainly fascinating. There it is. I'm stealing this from the speaker on Saturday. The speaker on Saturday made a big thing about how he, in full disclosure, he didn't know anybody anything. Trust me, I don't get paid by nobody. The reason for that is that when we start talking about the DSM series, historically, many of the researchers were being paid by pharmaceutical companies. And so, consequently, for full disclosure, we had to disclose that we were working with pharmaceutical companies. I pay out a lot of money to pharmaceutical companies, but the last time I knew, nobody ever paid me for one. So, good news is that we're clean of that particular set of issues. Mrs. Cruz, are you all ready? We're going to get started. Mrs. Cruz is 81 years old. All the other cases you're going to get are with children, so I figured I had to throw in a little first. Recently, her family was told that she had been diagnosed with a 294.11 major neurocognitive disorder due to her significant decline in memory, steadily progressive gradual decline in cognition without extended plateaus, and no evidence of mixed etiology. Are you ready for this, Howard?
Yeah,
that's
good.
Under DSM-4, they basically said she had dementia of the Alzheimer type. Okay. In a lot of ways, what DSM-5 is going to do is to work from categories and help us to be more specific in what we do. Because I've heard Howard say this a number of times, and so I'll pick on him, but Alzheimer's disease has a bad habit of becoming sort of a wastebasket diagnosis, because too much stuff gets thrown in there. And we can say that same thing about a whole bunch of other things. Let's talk ADHD. right? Can you say amen to that? All right. So there are lots of other diagnoses that have sort of become these places where we put things, where we sort of park people's problems. DSM-5 is all about a diagnosis that's going to somehow help you to treat people. Oh my goodness, we're really going to do that? I thought they were just to get paid. DSM-5 is all about moving us to have an accurate diagnosis so that from an accurate diagnosis, we can then work with people in a way that makes sense. And oh, by the way, we really don't want to label children if we can help them. And let's think that one through a little bit. Because of the long-term impacts, whether it's socially in the context of some kind of record following, or whether it is in terms of the child's own self-esteem, those labels go a long way. And the question is, where do they go? Carol and I were talking about even medications that are untried with children and how that impacts down the road. And so there's lots of things about this that we have to be kind of conscious of. And one of them is that my microphone keeps falling out. Hate it when that happens. You know, there's a reason for at least the young women in the room why your grandparents have you spreading needles. And this is right up there because it means having to put the thing in a little hole and make it work. Okay. Having bored you to death with that one, we'll move on. So, the question is to make it in small bites. Per my discussion, or per Rob's introduction, what we need to do is begin to figure DSM-4 versus DSM-5. For starters, DSM-5 is smaller. It's got fewer pages to it. Some of you will be relieved by that because you're carrying around all those books. But you'll be glad to know that for the next 2 years, all my students have to carry both of them, so they're not accomplishing anything. But be that as it may, again, we have 2 years to bring this in, and therefore 2 years to see whether or not it's going to work. There is some feeling in my mind that maybe it won't work. It very deliberately does not move toward trying to understand the issues that are necessary for insurances, which, of course, insurances help us to get paid. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the insurance companies pick up on this and where they go with it. But there are some things that the insurance companies aren't really excited about. And so it is possible that it won't go anywhere. For those of you who don't have licenses yet, FYI, for the next 2 years, you will be your licensing exams will come under DSM-4. And it will only be then 2 years from now that they will upgrade to DSM-5 for licensing exams. For those of you who have already graduated and haven't passed your exams, that should be motivation. And the program is what you know. Is the old DSM-4 system. Okay. Most of you are probably familiar with the history of the DSM series, but for those of you who, like me, are recovering community organizers, there is a fascinating history to it. There's also a typo in it. In the DSM-5, it says that the DSM series is based upon work that started in 1844. I think not. I'm thinking it's a typo. It should be 1944. Because effectively, no less than Carl Menninger and the folks in the U.S. Army, we get a lot of advances in medicine from the military in times of war. And the list just goes on and on from all the various wars. But in this particular case, Carl Menninger was in the military, and what he was doing was attempting to figure out how do you communicate what's going on with a particular soldier when you're moving them from one VA hospital to the next? And how do we be consistent about that? Because if you simply make what would amount to as observations of the person and pass them on, everybody's perspective is going to be a little different, and therefore we're not going to have any real consistency. So he came up with the first list in 44. It evolved into DSM-1 in 52. And the guy up Saturday sat up here and said that he had, in fact, practiced during all of these. I have to admit I've only practiced through four of them because I was born in 51, and so I really didn't do much with DSM-1. But the DSM-2 and DSM-3 series are ones that I remember very clearly. and practiced a long time under before DSM-4 and all the various gyrations above 3 and 4. I didn't bother to put them in here, but you can kind of see where it came from. It's critical that you think about the natures of how these systems... I don't know if you can hit that much too hard. how these various systems took place. For the most part, DSM-2 through DSM-4 were built as much on philosophies of individual therapy approaches as they were on any kind of evidence-based practice. DSM-2 is all about Sigmund Freud. No real surprise, right? This is the 1950s. Keeping in mind that Pavlov had been doing his work forever, but up until about the 1980s, most of the behavioral paradigms were greeted with suspicion by the general counseling community. And in fact, my friend Elsie Beekston always used to complain that only the behaviorists had to somehow defend themselves by having an ethics chapter at the end. That she said every counseling textbook ought to have an ethics chapter at the end, but only the behaviorists had to have that up until around 1980. So, for the most part, DSM-2 followed along the lines of diagnosing with Sigmund Freud. Sounds like a dance, doesn't it? Diagnosing with Sigmund Freud. I wonder if that's a two-step or a line dance. The symbolism there is killing me, but I don't know that. DSM-3 and DSM-4 were all about the individual philosophies of different theories. For example, I mentioned this a few minutes ago, DSM-4 and now DSM-5, as it's in the diagnostic section, is all about the work of Theodore Lamont under the heading of personalities. Now, most of you have taken some personality tests that actually connect up with the work of Carl Jung. What's the test that you always give, Rob? Myers-Briggs is a Jungian test, and therefore, technically, what you should take out of that is information out of Carl Jung's grab bag of understandings of counseling. And it's not per se in DSM-4 very clearly. There is one element within DSM-4 that begins to reflect its work. Most of the work actually comes from the work of Theodore Milan. So if you learn the work of Theodore Milan, you sort of understand the system. Most of these systems, however, were more philosophy than they were science. They were more thinking about a good idea. What was the sample size for Sigmund Freud? Let's see how good at least my alumni are. What was Sigmund Freud's sample size as a scientist? Yeah? And how many? He didn't have a 27. Maybe 28 if you included his mirror. He sort of needed that most of the time to figure that out. But for the most part, he was dealing with a very small sample size. What he was dealing with was a combination of philosophy and logic. We can take a look at it. What's an Oedipus complex? What's an Oedipus? Surely you had freshman Greek mythology. What's an Oedipus?
It's basically saying that the son is in love with the mother.
Right. And what's the Greek mythology that that's tied to?
That Oedipus was left on a mountain to die because when they told his future or his future back then, it said that he was going to kill his father, marry his mother, and have kids with his mother. And in the end, trying to run away from that because he was adopted by a family, he ended up actually killing his real father and marrying his mother.
I hope this is on the videotape because all of the people who teach Greek mythology at Baylor need to see this. Someone remembers Greek mythology. That's wonderful. Absolutely. The whole issue is that, just how scientific does that sound, right? Okay, I mean, you get the symbolism of it, but it's sort of hard to make evidence-based practice out of the whole concept that you're working with. So the original concepts often had more philosophy behind them than they actually had science. And that's okay. But it begs the question, and we're going to talk more about this, it begs the question, right at the moment, the various systems have some continuity between them. Now, those of you who have worked within one of the diagnostic systems will say, oh, well, there's these problems and these problems. But there's an umbrella construct that sort of holds them together if you follow it back. Into the new evidence-based system, there's no value for that umbrella. Therefore, it may or may not exist within the diagnostic streams that you're most interested in. So that's one of the changes that you're going to see in all of this, is the removal of the evidence base. Okay. Anything else about the history that anybody wants to talk about? I feel like I'm going to bore you to death with the rest of the truth. Any concerns? Defining mental health. Mental disorder. What's a mental disorder? The person is crazy, crackers, nuts. Mental disorders, by definition, have basically five elements to them. There's what we call mental disorder in the center, but around the outside, what you've got is personal distress. Personal distress. There's something wrong. Okay. There is the violation of social norms. Now, how subjective is that? You know, the whole cultural issue plays into there big time, because what might be considered normal to one might not be normal to another. That is why DSM 1 through 3, or at least 2 and 3 that I know of, according to the feminist psychologists that are out there, would tell you that PMS really is not as pathological as most males would think it is. Having raised two daughters, I question that, but bottom line is that it is evolving out of the system because it's, of course, a male perspective as opposed to something that would be experienced by the entire population. Disability. Something about the way a mental disorder works, it has to be somehow a functional issue for us. And that's a radical new thought. In fact, what we're going to be doing is thinking in terms of, is the situation, the clinical context that you're working with, is it syntonic or dystonic? Sounds like it ought to be a symphony, right? Syntonic and dystonic. I'm not getting anywhere with that one. No laughs there at all. Syntonic and dystonic. What does it mean? If it's syntonic, what does that mean to you? I like it. Okay? How many times have you sat down with a person who's addicted to something and you say, tell me about your love of pick a substance? And they say, oh yeah, good stuff, man. And then you try to figure out what they're there for. They're there because they had a fight with their spouse, or they're having trouble with the kids, or maybe they don't want the boss who's coming down on them. Or maybe that no good judge just didn't understand the fifth that they had before they went on wrestling. You know what I mean? Okay. If the fact of the matter is that the person has a syntonic condition, they're unlikely to want to change it. Therefore, the prioritization in DSM-5 is for dystonic conditions. Dystonic conditions basically meaning those are the ones you don't like. Those are the ones that, in the words of a psychologist friend of mine from years ago, she said, you know, there are just some things that are like a pebble in your shoe. And where the sneaker rubs, that's where you start working. So we start by asking ourselves the question, is it syntonic or dystonic? Now that's going to make our friends in addictions get real worried, because that might mean you're going to treat somebody for something other than the substance abuse first. And I'm interested to see how that plays itself out in clinical practice. Okay? But be that as it may, the final category up here is dysfunction. Usually a mental disorder has a dysfunction to it. That's why we all coined the question, so how's that working for you? Right. You got a person who's been doing a whole lot of stuff, and then so how's that working for you? Okay. I get the fact that it's hard to read in the yellow in the background. I tried to change some of that. I apologize. I should have changed some of that. You know, I'm going to have to put questions about this. For the most part, the principles of DSM-5 that guide us have to do with three basic things. Find me. client context, and of course agency capacity. How many of us would try to treat someone who got a disorder that's totally different from what you're accustomed to treating or what you're capable of being good at? We have a value for that in social work. We talk about competency as a value. And how many of us would actively go out to try to do something that's totally outside our competency area? That's good news for the students who are more or less over on this side of the room, I think. That's good news for you because it suggests you don't have to know everything about everything. Believe it or not, that's good. So agency capacity is a part of that. Client context is a part of that. And client need is a part of that. And again, what we're looking at is syntonic versus dystonic conditions because that becomes important on how we get into diagnostics. Okay? But the big thing to emphasize here is that DSM-5 is all about taking whatever's going on with that person and helping you to treat them. Too often in the past, the goal was a diagnosis rather than the goal being a treatment. And DSM-5 is all about the treatment. Okay. Other principles that are guiding this. The revision 5 or DSM-5 should be guided by evidence-based diagnostic criteria. I've already mentioned this. 2 and 3 were influenced by theory philosophy. 4 was still a lot of theory philosophy, though it tried to begin to get some evidence base in. And of course, the insurance companies were well in control of 4. And insurance and medication, the pharmaceutical industry. There's a lot of matching up the diagnosis with my medication in order to sell my medication. But it's fairly evident in DSM-4. And they actively worked to try to rid DSM-5 of that influence. To that end, they would only allow researchers to be a part of the planning team for DSM-5 if they, in fact, had not received any drug money, which made it sort of tough because so many people in this country who have prominence in these various areas also had drug money for their research. And to that end, they had to go into other countries to find an adequate number of people to steer where this headed. I think from a cultural perspective, that's also probably why it's stronger culturally than it was, because it has brought in so many people from other places. DSM-5, then, starts with evidence-based literature. Now, here again, in 1 through 4, TR, whatever, 1 through 4 had a philosophy behind them. And philosophers work really hard at having continuity of thought within what they do. Researchers that are doing things quantitatively, not so much. They try to assemble a mosaic of concepts, and then maybe there's philosophy underneath to kind of hold it up. But it is going to make a difference in how things work together or don't work together in a new design that, quite frankly, believes that there is a lot of overlap between diagnoses. To try to treat them as being sui generis doesn't work. You all know what sui generis means? Mutually exclusive. It's a big word. I had to throw at least one 25-cent word in to make it, you know, fun. They honestly thought in the past that all these diagnoses were somehow mutually exclusive. Make that happen, you know, you learn this diagnosis, you find this person. Practitioners, how many times have you seen someone who exactly fits the model that you're diagnosing? Not a lot. If symptoms are never as clear as we'd like to think they are, and if you don't believe that, ask my students in the Monday morning class who are trying to discern cases, because I keep telling them it's hard to figure out, you know, what one diagnosis is and the other. Of course, I still grade them on it. The second thing that they did was they moved to the field trials as a second layer. And so they had clinics. There were some here in Waco. There are many of them here in Texas, particularly around Dallas and Houston, who were very active in the field trials of these things. Basically, they came up with what they read from the evidence-based literature. They moved that then into the field trials to kind of see if what these criteria were doing made sense. And then they came out with the book. This book is somewhere between, depending on who you ask, 5 and 6 years out late in coming out, because it took so long to pull all this out. Organizational structure. You know, it feels sometimes like every time I learn a new TV show paradigm, the group of people who really loved it get too old to be in my classes. And then I have to learn a whole new one. Have you noticed that one, Preston? You know, I just finally figured out Harry Potter, and now I realize none of my students really know who Harry Potter is. No. Most of you probably don't recognize this, but it's the chessboard off of Star Trek. Now, that's digging back, right? You know? So those old parts have to figure that one out. All right. The DSM-IV system, the first thing about DSM-5 they were trying to do was harmonize with the ICD-11 code. ICD codes are the medical codes that physicians work with, and of course, psychiatrists are physicians. And therefore, what they're trying to do is to get their two worlds to come together. Remember that this whole book, this whole series, comes out of the American Psychiatric, not Psychological Association. And so these were psychiatrists trying to make their life easier. What they're doing is pairing it with the ICD-11 code. My suspicion, if I had to commit myself today to how this will work out for funding, is that the psychiatrist will use the ICD codes to get their diagnoses in order to get funding for their jobs. And we just will stop seeing the psychiatrists using the DSM-5 codes simply because in DSM-5 you're actually encouraged not to make a diagnosis unless you're really sure about it, which doesn't help a thing in terms of trying to get your reimbursement back. Okay? The old access system was very much like the Star Trek board. I actually tried to buy one of these once because I thought it would be really cool to have in my office to be able to show to people. They wanted like $300 for it, and I said, not that cool. Okay. But you can kind of see the idea here is that each one of these is a different level, and you're actually playing horizontally, not just vertically. Most of the time when you are playing chess, what you're doing is playing horizontally. You're playing across the chessboard. Even Wizard's Chest was a flat board. I know, none of you all have heard of Harry Potter. That's the flat surface of it. But what would be happening if it made it more fascinating, wouldn't it? If you had to work up and down, not just across the side to side. And that's virtually what we've been doing in DSM-IV. We've been trying to work what they call a multi-axial system. Multi-axial system, I'm not even saying it right, multi-access system. Is that better? The multi-access system basically said that you had to take a look at the integration of the various elements. They used access 5, the GAF scores, as their intensity score. How bad is it? How dysfunctional are they, kind of thing? And access 1 through 4 were the various elements for the understanding of the person. But they had some qualities to them that basically suggested that you could find a pure diagnosis by putting all of this together. Now, what they did do that was right was they figured out that something like a general medical condition could, in fact, have an impact on your psyche. Hello? You cut my leg off, I'm likely to have feelings about it, Dr. Freud. Not just the old issue of it's all in your head. You know, you cut my leg off, it's not my mother's fault, trust me. Okay. So, consequently, the integration of the various concepts came by moving back and forth between the axes. So you would diagnose a multi-axial diagnosis. Was allowing you to be able to take a look at, say, a medical condition, and then you would add a personality disorder to that at another level, and you would add a clinical disorder to that at another level, and what you got was one really messed up dude. Okay. But it has to, the issue here is that these are sort of, from a practice perspective, they're not as mutually exclusive as DSM-IV would like to make it seem, because they bleed a lot, don't they? Okay. But, at least in DSM-IV, it's as if somehow you've got these boxes and you can kind of move them along. I would argue that it looks a little bit, if you have to envision it, like a chess game. I'm going to get that over the shoulder move here any day now. So, effectively, we're no longer required to make a diagnosis at all. Now, there's a radical concept. Again, it'd be interesting to see how this plays in insurance and reimbursement. But basically, in DSM-5, they would rather you not make a diagnosis if you're not sure. What that's going to do then is to reduce the amount of times that we use the NOS code. NOS, for those of you keeping track, is not otherwise specified. It also says nose, and I would like to get into nosology, so let's not lose our noses here. But not otherwise specified, that what the complaint is that there are too many people that go for too many years with an NOS diagnosis instead of something more concrete. And so while there is still an NOS category within DSM-5, it's discouraged. Because they'd rather you not have a diagnosis than to have something that basically just says, we're fixing to figure it out. And that's okay if it's temporary, but to have that on a chart for 2 or 3 years is probably not so helpful. Okay? So we had originally a dimensional approach to diagnosis that in 1-5 promoted this mutually exclusive sui generis diagnostic system. DSM-5 recognizes the widespread sharing of symptoms. Radical concept. It basically is going to look more like clustering than the Star Trek chessboard. Okay. This changes the assumption that a legitimate disease is discrete and that it has a characteristic clinical course. Perhaps equally important, the behavioral and emotional symptoms are presumed, there's a P missing there, to reflect an underlying mechanism often referred to as the medicalization of psychology. DSM-5 organization is intended to bridge forward to new approaches with new diagnoses. Emphasis then is also on, get this, developmental lifespan issues. Now, there's a radical concept. You know, how many of us back in the dark ages took developmental psychology and then sort of set it aside when we got into abnormal psychology because it didn't feel like the two of them made any difference to one another? But those of you who work in developmental areas, particularly with children, get this, I think, because we got to start taking into consideration what the distinction is and how it works. Just to give you a geriatric example of that, Howard and I, as we worked on grief and Alzheimer patients, we're starting from the concept that in pediatrics, when you're working with children, if you're deciding whether or not a child should be able to go to a funeral, you have the capacity for abstraction as a developmental issue to be able to judge whether or not the person would understand what a death was or a funeral was. And if the child can understand the abstraction of something like heaven or life, then that should be a clear green light for them to be able to come to the funeral. Up to that point, you may want to consider how they will understand that death. What the old age, and Dr. Harris will help me with this, is the whole issue of you never tell a child that grandma or grandpa's gone to sleep. And why don't you do that, Dr. Harris?
Because the child might be scared to go to sleep.
Yeah. And who pays that price, Mom and Dad? Yeah. So you avoid that mistake, right? And you try to make it work. So the developmental issues make a difference. The problem we have in geriatrics is that there is no such point in the Alzheimer process. Now, Howard keeps trying to explain to me that you really do unravel your brain in Alzheimer's disease in reverse to it being rolled up the first time.
Retrogenesis.
Thank you so much. Retrogenesis. I was resisting that concept. And Howard was most persuasive to say it really does work that way. See, from my perspective, that also has the potential of infantilizing an older adult. And that, to me, is a bad thing. However, if it helps us to understand and borrow a concept from our child welfare friends, maybe it's useful. So the question is, what is the capacity for abstraction? But I would dare say we can figure that out easier in children than we can dementia patients at this point. So that becomes a new challenge to try to work on if we're trying to decide whether or not someone should go to a funeral service. Because what you do hear are all of the lively stories about how grandma, when we took her to the funeral, jumped into the casket and tried to go to bed with her husband who was laying there. It's amazing how that story gets around to virtually everybody before they make that decision. and then therefore somehow they don't make that decision. The justice or ethics issue involved in that is if you've been married to somebody for 65 years, you do not have the right to be able to say goodbye to someone. Okay. So there's some tension in there somewhere. But lifespan issues become really a lot more important for us. Gender is the other thing. I get the feeling that they're trying to tell us there really is a difference between boys and girls. I'm a gerontologist. They all look alike to me. But there's this real sense that gender makes a difference in how we diagnose. And we went through a time in which we were trying so hard to de-genderify. Is that a word? Probably not. We were trying to take gender out of things so much that we weren't recognizing that maybe it in fact plays a role in some of our diagnostic work. So they're trying to pay attention to that. They're still fixing to figure it out. But it's kind of have a heavy fun. So the old structure has to do with this kind of piled on. Remember, this is your Star Trek warrior chessboard here, where it's sort of working horizontally and vertically at the concept. DSM-5 is this sort of amalgamation. DSM-5 puts them all in a bag and it says, take a look at what's going on. What are the dystonic, what are the syntonic symptoms, and how are you going to relate those symptoms? And maybe they don't all relate the same way. Maybe there isn't this kind of perfect template that you can put them in order with. Those of you who've already graduated, be glad, because those of us who teach this have to figure out how to explain this now scattered system. I'll call it a dynamic system to give it a word, right? This new dynamic system, because it's a lot easier to teach the categories than it is to teach to this kind of amalgamation. And yet, student thing gets out into your field placement, those of you who are in field placements, and lo and behold, it isn't all cookie cutter clean, as the books would like to make it look like, right? You heard that here first. So, here is probably the best chart. You'll notice I swiped it. Probably the best chart to talk about what things have moved over from DSM-4 to DSM-5. Effectively, what they have done is take axis 1, 2, and 3 and moved it all over into what they're calling a psychometric design area. Diagnostic area. DSM-4, which was always their emotional, psychosocial, emotional, cultural kind of an area, it moves over into psychosocial contextual factors. And then 5 was the GAF score. Now, those of you who are heavily dependent on GAF scores, how many of you actually use the GAF score today? Some of you, I'm sure, do in your agency. Higher, I can't. Okay. GAF scores. Students do get used, okay? But the bad news is you need to learn a whole new system. Because what they want you to do is to move to the WHO assessment system, which is, and frankly, I have not been able to spend much time with it, but the WHO, the World Health Organization system, has far more culture in it, and I'm told it's easier to work with. But don't take that from me. We'll get into that together when we can get a hold of it. But so, what we're doing is exchanging. It says disability up on the chart, but what we're really looking at there is the WHO level of disability kind of construct moving on. So, FYI, we're making some difference. Now, we promised you values and ethics credit, so let's move that direction, having kind of talked through the structure of the differences. Any questions before we move on? Anybody with smoke coming out of their ears? I don't see that as behavioral symptom yet. So. All right. When you think about social work ethics, you think about the values and ethics that we have in the field. For those of you who are a little younger than Preston and some of the rest of us are, the field of social work didn't always have a set of values. It's pretty much always had a code of ethics. All your faculties have a head code of ethics? All of mine they have, but we're older than I am. Okay. They've always had a code of ethics, but not a code of values. In the early 1970s, when I was a dual student at McCormick Seminary and the University of Chicago School of Social Work, we brought together the Presbyterian clergy and the social work faculty at the University of Chicago, and we were comparing values and ethics. And at the end of the day, we concluded that Presbyterian clergy have a value system and no ethics, and social workers have ethics and no values. Now, you've figured out that we have corrected that, right? We now have both values and ethics. But the interesting thing about it is that they're sort of retrofitted. The values that are there, somebody basically said, gee, we should have that. And in the Presbyterian clergy side, which, by the way, they do now have a statement of ethics, but that came from the drive of all the pedophile activities and, among the churches, and so they figured they better have an ethics statement to make things pretty clear. So both groups have caught up on all that, but they are different and something to be kind of concerned about. So down here at the bottom, in theory, remember I said that values and ethics, if you talk to an ethicist, start from some kind of, I'll call it a theory, but they would call it philosophy or theology. The two disciplines you find ethicists coming out of are either theologians or they are philosophers of some sort. Okay? And for the most part, then, our philosophies in social work have to do with humanism and positivism. Humanism and positivism. We'd like to think humanism is older, technically it's not, but it was embraced for a much longer time. And most of our values and many of our ethics actually are humanistically based, not positivism based. But I'll go through the difference in that one in a minute. Wedged into that, then, are the social work values and ethics. And sitting on top of that, then, are what you have to function with in your daily practice of values and ethics. To some extent, in my experience in the community, a lot of values and ethics come out of what amount to good practices. You know that you shouldn't do this because it's just not done because it's a bad thing to do, as opposed to from some baseline philosophy. And a lot of folks go through their careers kind of on that level. And that's okay, but the one thing I will say is that I'm often put on panels with lawyers to talk about ethics. And I've stopped doing that in the last 5 or 10 years because when an ethicist is on a panel with a lawyer, and I'm not per se an ethicist, but I get accused of that from time to time, what happens is all the questions go to the lawyers because what social workers really want to know is what's going to keep them out of jail, not necessarily what's morally correct. And from where I sit, morally correct counts. That's my other head, it's clergy person, right? So if morally correct counts, then let's think about it as morally correct, and let's hope there's a kind of correlation between morally correct and legal, which I can't always guarantee, but we'll fake it, right? Okay. So we'll kind of move on. And I have to move on very fast because time is in its fourth house. And Herman runs a tight ship. Positivism. We all love a positivism. In short, positivism is scientific method. It goes back to the 1600s. Positivism is basically a view of the world that everything can be scientifically understood and worked out. Therefore, if you're working out of positivism as your base, you're going to be working from behaviors and or cognitions, not feelings. That's the old question, what comes first, the feeling, the behavior, or the thought? In positivism, it's always a behavior or a thought because those can be counted. If I hold my hand up, Cheryl, hold your hand up, Preston, hold your hand up, how many hands are up? Everybody agree? Okay. Preston, have a thought with me for a minute about a favorite place. Probably in Georgia, and there's a pond in it, at least according to your cousin. No, I'm not. Okay. Cheryl, what's your favorite? Make a thought. Experience that you really, really think is cool. You have to go. I'm going to do the same. Now, how many do we have and what are they? The problem with humanism is counting these things. Tough to pull off. We can count the number of hands in the air. That's the objective. But positivism is all about objectifying rather than subjectifying what goes on between you and a client. A.K.A. then, the behavioral theories that became popular out of the work of B.F. Skinner. There are lots of other people that contributed to that, but in this country, Skinner seemed to have kind of carried the torch into the 60s, 70s, and 80s. By the 80s, behavioral methods were taking on with a little help from two or three other people. The then cognitive behavioral approach, Ellison, began to morph into the behavioral theories, because we used to talk about behavior modification or behavioral therapy. Behavior modification is where I change your behavior based upon an environment. Still do that on a dimension unit, still do that with small children, but it's because they're incapable of making their own informed choice decision. But today, we always do behavioral therapy as an approach, because that means you sit down with a person and they decide what they're going to change and move on to change. So behavioral therapy, and then we moved into bringing the cognitive into that. The cognitive tends to work a lot like behavioral, and that marries the two and brings us into cognitive behavioral therapy, at which point you then get into the various other pieces of this that we can talk about that are sort of refinements, if you will, of CBT, although some of them would deny that and claim they're separate, but they come out of a positivist grip. We have a philosophy, then, of positivism to pay attention to underneath our field of concern. We also have this old humanistic category. In the broadest category or way of thinking about it, humanism is a broad category of ethical philosophies that affirm the dignity and worth of the person. Person first, person second. That gets us in trouble with the folks who are theologically trained, because folks with a theological spread would like us to think about God somewhere in that discussion. And a true humanist has very little use for God within the middle of it. So then you get down to the principles. Human beings are each unique. There's values. The principal value under humanism is freedom of choice. Okay. I'm going to put the pedal to the metal here because Irma's going to get mad at me if I go too much longer. I'm going to make you the culprit of that, Irma. Okay. So, principle-based ethics is what we have fallen into in the various counseling professions. First proposed in the 1930s, most mental health and medical ethics codes are based on principle-based ethics. What kind of principles you want to put forward? If you take a look at the values and ethics within our code, it's basically principle-based. The other options are process ethics or legalistic ethics. Some of you go to church and you listen to legalistic ethics, or you listen to process ethics as the way to think about things from your faith dimension. But in social work circles, what we're using is a principle-based concept. One can argue that that comes because we can't all agree on the same philosophy. But that's just me, maybe, right? But when you take a look at that, it's things like the first four basic principles under principle-based ethics: respect for autonomy, non-malfeasance, beneficence, and justice. You've probably seen those somewhere before. I think they have caduceus that goes with them to work it out. Values and ethics. Then this is the INSW system. You can kind of see, I actually swiped this from John Singletary, who eliminated a bunch of these about 9 years ago, and I still have mine under my blotter for that. Sorry, I couldn't give you all what he treated us to back then. But basically, you can connect, and you can see the lines if you can look back closely, between service and help for people that kind of go down. Social justice connects up with challenge social justice. Dignity and worth of the person goes into reject the inherent dignity and worth of the person. Reject, is that right? Did you have a title? Certainly not.
Sure, it was mine.
Yeah. The importance of human relationships. Integrity, and then confidence. It is probably my tempo. I'll get John off the hook on this. I can tell it's mine. Specific values in DSM-5, things to pay attention to. The importance of human relationships. Patient well-being, social acceptance, human relationships, access to treatment, cultural and familial support. Dignity and worth of the person. Where have you seen these before, right? This gets us into holism for those of us concerned about faith and practice. Competence, accurate diagnosis, accurate practice, even research, and finally social justice. So I want us to turn to the things that are on your table. What we've been talking about is referred to as the nosologies of DSM-5, or if you will, diagnostic process. The nosology has nothing to do with a nose. Last week, the IRB that I sit on for Baylor had to discuss what hippotherapy was. It took us the first 5 minutes to figure out it had nothing to do with an animal that's really large who wallows around in the short grass and water. Of course, has to do with equestrian treatment techniques. But, you know, you got to watch out for your words, right? So it has nothing to do with the nose. But the question that I want to pose, and on your each one of your tables, there is one set of these slides. What I want each group to do is to take a look at their slides and pick one that they can talk about. Okay? So the first one is, how will shifts in nosology impact the internalization of the pathology for patients and their advocates? The second one is, what will the impact of advocacy interest groups do in shaping the new nosology? How will moving from philosophy to evidence-based shape the process? And is confining religion, spirituality, to culture adequate for client support? Different ethical questions to kind of think about. Now, I'm up against the existential issue. How should I proceed?
Hey! Everybody ready? All rhymes and all terms.
Did the question of how will the shifts of nosology impact the internalization of pathology for patients with their advocates? Just hold up your hands if you use that issue. Ooh, popular. Moving on. It says nosology. Everybody just stopped it. What will be the impact of advocacy interest groups on the shaping of a new system? How will moving from philosophy to evidence-based practice shape our diagnosis? Okay, we got one. All right. What did you select? Values of research. Now explain it to us. What do you mean?
Well, if we're moving...
This is very slow.
If we're going to move to a more positivistic approach, then we're really in many ways putting all of our marbles in one jar, because we're saying we've got to have research to back everything that we're doing. And particularly in diagnosis, that there has to be research to support that.
Okay. So effectively, what we're saying is research is there. What's the ethical issue there, do you think? What are the value issues there? Are there value issues that you can spot just off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, the first thing I thought of is we got some real issues in doing research on people.
Okay. A lot of issues of doing research on people. The answer to the question is, why don't we do more research on kids? I sit on the Institutional Review Board for Baylor, and I can tell you it's nearly impossible to get through child studies because of so many protections in the federal system for child studies. It can be done, but it is tough to do, and therefore we just don't have the research. And yet, take a look around at all the people who work with kids. So how are we going to achieve evidence-based criteria when not doing the research? It poses a problem. Okay? So did everybody else do the last one? I see that panel over there, sister. I see that hand, sister. Hold that up.
So the last question. Is defining religion, spirituality, and culture adequate for client support? We said no. And we... pick the value of holism, and they're saying that like it can for those religions that like believe in God and limit the movement of God by just like confining it to as a category of culture. And then, you know, that category is like a little too vague. You know, there's just so much that can be covered under it. And then it also puts limits on the client's understanding of like their faith and the way they how their religion or spirituality like works in aiding their
aiding
their like treatment
or recovery. Super. Thank you. That's right. That's very helpful. Who else had a thought on that one?
Our only thought was that in our work with veterans in a residential treatment facility, there's a lot of good spiritual discussion about there's a piece of mental health insanity that can't be separated from spirituality, but it can have absolutely nothing to do with faith practice. So the religion / spirituality is something we felt like we really wanted to separate. They can be both banned, or they can be either or, they can be some combination of the two. And it was important to welcome in people with no faith tradition into the spiritual conversation.
Given the fact that the Air Force has just voted to take In God We Trust out of their oath, just by the way, that'll be a new and interesting wrinkle in all of this, because there's a lot of pressure in the military to take God out of a lot of things. And that's the military, the only place to let it do. But part of the issue there is that religion and spirituality have been around these concepts for a long time. Clearly in the military, there's been a chaplain of every unit going back to the Revolution, probably the French and Indian War too, for all I know. Religion has sort of been mixed in there, but of course then it raises the question of how it gets mixed in. Religion is not a pathology. That's the problem of the Fort Hood shooter, as anybody's keeping track. The fellow who did the shooting in Fort Hood, he really wants to be known as a person who sacrificed his life for Islam. And the problem he had with his lawyers was they wanted him to plead insanity. And that meant pleading secondary PTSD. secondary PTSD is a pathology under what is now the new stress spectrum disorder group. But religion is still a V code. The same V codes from DSM-4 have been pushed over to DSM-5. And as someone said over at this table, pretty much everybody in the room has at least one V code in their own portfolio personally. Because that's the nature of what those are. They're basically flavorings for a lie, right? But you can't get a mental illness defense in court from a V code. And therefore, the kind of bizarre court proceeding that we all saw earlier this fall was the result of what amounts to DSM-4 and how it arranges this. DSM-5, however, adds this major section on culture. And in the major section on culture, it can't seem to stop using the term spirituality. And so what it has done is embed religion and spirituality under culture. Now, we've been doing that in professions for quite a long time. Psychology, clinical, licensed professional social workers, and social workers, licensed professional social, licensed professional counselors, I apologize to an owner, social workers. We have all basically said that religion and spirituality are important. They get slid under culture. And therefore, in a school that doesn't have faith as an issue or a concern for it, where you would find anything about religion and spirituality would be in some kind of culture, a discussion of culture.
Why are we tying religion and spirituality together?
Good question. They
become handled easier if we separate.
Well, and it certainly would help some of the political issues. But it's still in DSM-4, it's a slash, religion / spirituality, where you see them together at all. So those are the issues. Holism, of course, is the issue of seeing the whole person, and so the question is, does he need to be? Anybody else have a comment on this? Anyone else have some thoughts? Well, lots here to talk about, and when we start drilling down into any one of these are 3-hour discussions. So we can't really get to our time to try to what your thoughts about them so we begin to talk about it. What we've talked about though here this afternoon is that basically the structure of DSM-5 is different from the structure of DSM-4. And while some of the elements are the same, personality disorders are still roughly the same, it's pointing to, it's got a new section called Future Areas for Research in it, and the whole new concept of personality is very there, and it basically says, fix and think about this area. Religion, and the whole question of religion is a V-code is still there, but now under culture, we firmly embed spirituality and religion as a cultural content. The question is that adequate? The question that Dr. Harris and Dr. Yancey and I are asking these days is it possible that a miracle might have nothing to do with pathology? And if that's the case, how do I, as a clinician, sort out the difference between some kind of delusion or hallucinatory factor and a miracle? How do I know the difference? The only diagnostic criteria I know is an old joke. What's the difference between a hallucinating schizophrenic and a mystic? The answer to the joke is the mystic knows who to tell. Well, for those of you who didn't follow that, the issue is that a hallucinating schizophrenic will tell anybody about the physical experience, so they'll want to talk about it, and that's an issue. Where the mystic only talks to people who might believe in what they're talking about, and they understand reality before and after their physical experience. Where for the hallucinating schizophrenic, they're up against the whole way. But that's nowhere in scientific literature. That's not a joke. So the question is, how do we understand those things? But you have to be believing that there's a capability of it to move forward with that. We can make the same case for a lot of the other diagnoses that some of you spend your days with. ADHD would be another one. When you start drilling down into it, taking a look at it, all of the nuances that looks like, and what are the issues that you have to be presented with. And the good news is, we have a panel of really crack folks who are going to help us with that right after a break. And to quote McDonald's, you deserve a break today. So let's take a break, and we will come back.
We'll start back at 3:15.
And we'll have our panel.
We hope that you enjoyed this training. Please remember to take the post-test and the course evaluation in order to receive your CEU certificate. If you have any additional input or questions, please don't hesitate to contact us at the information you can find on our main webpage or email us at info@nacsw.org. We hope that you will consider taking additional courses on topics sensitive to the thoughtful integration of faith, spirituality, and social work practices through our program. Thanks again, and thanks for supporting NACSW.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the member section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.